then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's September the 27th, 1914. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Greetings, comrades. This is Andy Donner from Seattle. I've often wondered why I encounter so much misunderstanding of the Northwest Imperative. Granted, it's all on the Internet, and the Internet doesn't count for anything as far as the movement goes. Even if it did, the naysays come from nuts who won't offer up any other solution. Still, I feel some responsibility to set the record straight on a number of ideas. There is a lot of misunderstanding about the idea of Northwest migration in general, and in my estimation, much of that comes from the idea we're just moving up here to Valhalla land and camping out until something happens. In reality, true racial migrants to the Northwest are following the Butler Plan. We've heard from racially minded migrants on RFN who moved here before the Northwest Front existed, and they weren't even aware of the Butler Plan. Many months ago, I met a comrade in Washington State who brought his family here under the Northwest Migration before the Northwest Migration was even being pushed. Clearly, this is more than just organic migration, and we're not making the idea up from nothing. The Butler Plan calls for the creation of an all-white political entity separate from the United States of America, composed of the former states of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. The Northwest Front now aims to include the western part of Montana, and at the time of independence, we would like to include as much of the territory around the current proposed border as we can. This means true Northwest migration isn't about driving in a general direction northwest and stopping wherever you find convenient. Your help is badly needed in the homeland, and stopping short doesn't cut it for purposes of the migration. After all, the purpose of the migration isn't just to form white communities. As important as those communities are, our ultimate goal is to bring about revolution, and that requires some hard and fast parameters within the overall plan. You can't participate in a movement which doesn't operate in your area. The idea of Northwest migration existed before the Northwest Front and even before the current group of activists was involved. Because of this, there is some legitimate misunderstanding in the white nationalist community. Many interested individuals don't fully explore our intent, which can be done at northwestfront.org, and therefore don't really complete the migration. The migration isn't for the sake of migration or for the sake of white communities, but for the sake of our independence. That time is likely far off, yes, but we must act in accordance with our true objective. I recently had an online interaction with someone I suspect to be one of Harold Covington's goat dancers. This individual's main complaint was about the Northwest Front's lack of offerings. To be perfectly honest, it was more about Harold Covington's lack of offerings, which further hurt his case, since the Northwest Imperative isn't a Harold Covington invention. But that's beside the point. Let me be clear. It is not our job to offer you anything. Each white nationalist has many racial heroes, and I can't quite bring myself to imagine any of them complaining about their struggles to the point where their main lament would be, "No one gave me anything. It was too hard." The Northwest Front would love to be able to provide a total safety blanket, but unless we get more migrants, it won't happen that way. We periodically get the word out about new migrants, and their stories are an excellent demonstration of what needs to occur from within each white nationalist. Recently, while driving home from buying my groceries, I passed a construction crew on State Highway 99. There was only one non-white out of the 20-plus large crew. My job has recently taken me away from downtown Seattle, and I now walk past another construction site to work. The crew I saw this week was all white and on the whole younger than most crews I see. Lately, every business I've walked into has young white people in it. There are jobs here for white people if they're willing to work. I chose to change jobs in Seattle shortly after migrating from out there. I had multiple interviews and offers inside of 2 weeks. I still have recruiters on my case regularly. We had a new comrade and his family move into the area 2 weeks ago, and he now has work. He made a scouting trip not too long before his move, and because of that, he knew exactly what to do when he arrived here. Harold Covington, some other comrades, and myself had the privilege of helping his family land here and get settled into their own place. It's a nice white area and getting whiter all the time. While it is true there aren't nearly as many of us as there should be, people are making the migration despite what the anti-Northwest imperative propaganda tells you. When they do arrive, we do what we can to help them out. It's not much of a support network, no, but that's because you're not here yet. Once again, we see the internet movement has no bearing on real-world racial activity, and the Northwest migration is occurring, albeit far too slowly. If you have marketable skills and can keep a job, you have no reason not to migrate at the first possible moment. Save your money, plan your move, decide where you want to live in the homeland, and make your scouting trip. It will take some time and effort. It certainly won't happen overnight. My migration took a year to pull off, and it is a long haul for sure. But you know it is right, and you know you can do it if you work a little each day at it. Really, you only need two things to come home. You need the will to do so and the discipline to see the work through. Set aside a little bit of time each day to worry about migrating for the sake of your race, and you'll eventually come through for yourself, your children, and the future Northwest American Republic. Above all else, except perhaps saving money to pad your finances during and after your move, begin preparing for the move itself. You certainly have things you can't or won't bring with you, and these items could be taken care of immediately. Just this simple act helps prepare your mind to accept the remaining effort of migration as well as jumpstart your migration mindset. If anything, your priorities and decision-making abilities are exercised in the process, and this is part of the inner transformation required to save our race from extinction. The act of migration is our racial survival more so than any future NVA campaign or other fighting with Zog. After making my own migration, I realized the perseverance and dedication of the Migration Act constituted what so many racial whites in our country claim to desperately desire. I hope to see each and every one of you here sooner rather than later. Hail victory, comrades.
I figured we'd let somebody else open this week. Another reminder that the NF is not just a one-man band. Okay, let me ask you guys a question. Why the hell do foreigners get the Northwest migration in a way that native-born Americans never seem to? Now, we were honored this week with yet another visitor from Europe. Now, I tell you, it's a pretty freaky honor for me when somebody flies halfway around the world just to meet me. He's already begun the long and arduous process of getting a U.S. job offer and getting a company to sponsor him, and then the almost endless bureaucracy of getting properly zilchified and sanctified with a green card so we can come here. At any given moment, we have 4 or 5 Canadians who are desperately scrabbling at the border trying to find a way to come and live here legally, and there's some possibility that in the next few months we're going to receive our first scouting trip visitor from Australia. And here are all you guys sitting on your butts out there like pale blobs behind your computers in Alabama and Ohio and Michigan and Texas and California with no need to get green cards or visas, with the full legal right to live and move anywhere on the continent you want. All you have to do is pack the U-Haul and hit the interstate to come here to the homeland where God and destiny have told us that we need to be. You can do something that these foreigners would give anything to have the right to do. And more than once, I have had them ask me, what the hell is wrong with these Americans? Why aren't they coming here in droves? Well, guys, if you figure it out, please tell me. Anyway, speaking of Canadians, here's an email I received from Travis in Ontario. Dear Harold, I was listening to your podcast when someone asked you if there was ever going to be a movie of your novels, and you explained to him that no Burger King in the Hull Hoax Factory would ever even touch the script for fear of a third-degree burn. Well, I have an idea that hopefully nobody has pitched yet, but probably have. If I could get a few of my buddies to get together and make short YouTube clips based on certain events in the Northwest novels, for example, the Brigade, the infamous 20 seconds of footage of the shootout on Flanders Street, or my personal favorite, the scene where the Hebrew Hammer enters Erica Collingwood's apartment for an unpleasant surprise, all to the soundtrack of Lorena McKennitt, The Mummer's Dance. At the end of the clips, we'll link to the book by you and link to northwestfront.org. What do you think? Signed, Travis. Okay, as those of you who are on the Northwest Revolution email list are aware, we do have something that I refer to as the Colonel House Academy of Northwest Cinematic Arts, which is a small group of YouTube impresarios who are making their own YouTube videos either with footage that I provide or using their own skills and materials. Now, just to make it clear to everyone listening to this, I am not some Hollywood Jew who screams in hysteria about my poor violated copyright if somebody decides they want to do something creative with my novels, or with these podcasts, or with anything that I do or say or write. I don't write my books or speak these podcasts or write my blogs and my articles for money, which is probably why I have so little of it. I constantly get read the riot act by my friends for giving my stuff away. If someone sends me an email whining about how terribly poor they are, and please, please, pretty please, with sugar on top, can I send them a free copy of any of the novels by PDF attachment, they got it. I am notoriously easy to shake loose of actual book copies for free as well. All you have to do is write me a reasonably intelligent and correctly spelled email or letter, begging and pleading and vowing and swearing that someday you'll pay for the book, but oh, you're just so poor now, and you lost your job, and you're caring for your aged mama, and your dog died, and so forth and so on, and I'll lose $100 sending you all 5 books priority mail. Hey, it happens all the time. I am a shamefully soft touch. I will send my books to anybody I think might have the brains to understand them and, who knows, maybe even the courage to act on them. And it has to be that way. I have to take a chance. I have to take the risk that the book I send out for free might be the seed that falls in the fertile soil and gets me some actual physical help up here. I have to take the gamble that the free book I send out now might bring us a national organizer a few years down the road. I know Sally thinks this is funny and doesn't believe it, but I am still convinced that somewhere out there in internet land or otherwise, somehow reachable, is the Northwest Movement's George Lincoln Rockwell. Someone who is younger than me, someone who is in good health with some mileage left on the clock. Someone who is a people person and actually relishes doing the kind of work that I regard as a life and work paralyzing distraction. Somebody who has the fire in the belly and the oratorical and organizational skills and the personal integrity to make TLC, Total Life Commitment to the Northwest Republic. Someone who will actually do something with all of this, standing up in a Northwest park somewhere wearing a cape and leaping from picnic table to picnic table, rousing the rabble, or just whatever the hell it is you guys seem to think I should be doing. Anyway, what I'm telling you is this. Anyone has my permission to do pretty much anything with any of my work, written or electronic, just so it helps advance the 14 words of the cause of the Northwest American Republic. You do not need to ask my permission. I am constantly amazed and overjoyed at some of the things that I see on YouTube and blogs and websites about my novels and about the Northwest Imperative. Stuff that is done sometimes by a teenage boy hiding from the world in his room behind his computer, as so many young white boys do. Maybe doing a YouTube or a website or battling goat dancers on a blog will give him the courage to step out from behind the computer one day. Or at least bring his computer up here to the Northwest homeland where they belong. On a different but tangentially similar note, this is an email that I received from Burton in Oklahoma City. Dear HAC, I keep trying to promote the Northwest Migration and the NorthwestFront.org site on forums like Stormfront, VNN, and eNationalist.com, as well as some others. But the moderators delete my posts and refuse to give me any explanation except that any mention of you and the Northwest is banned, and when I persist or try to argue with them, they delete my account and block my IP. What the fuck is wrong with these idiots? Are they Jewish infiltrators? Signed, Burton. No, Barton, they're not Jewish infiltrators. The truth is a lot simpler and, in a way, a lot more sad and contemptible than that. The simple and brutal fact is that the grand poobahs of the V bulletin boards view us as the competition, and they are desperate to keep their own little flock of followers and butt buddies on their forums from finding out that someone is actually, really, trying to do something about all this and take white nationalism off the internet and back into the real world. It is also a disgraceful fact that they view us, correctly, as financial competition in the racial entertainment business. Now, I say correctly because, in the simplest terms, any time you send $10 to the Northwest Front, that's $10 you're not sending to Don Black or Alex Linder or one of the other white lords of the internet. Now, these people view us as taking the cheesy poofs out of their children's mouths or whatever. What you have to understand, Burton, is that the Northwest Front has an actual plan, a simple and completely legal plan that can be actually carried out here in the real physical world by anybody with the small amount of self-discipline and perseverance necessary to work a job for a year or so and save some money. This terrifies the rest of these movement personalities who have no plan at all and who could offer white people nothing but endless internet. Now, we have what so many white people are searching for, and people like Alex Linder and Jamie Kelso don't dare let their own audiences know that it exists. They understand that if they ever allow the Northwest Front or the Northwest Imperative in any form a level playing field on their forums, all their little cyber friends and their internet followers will see the fact that we are the only ones with a plan and the only people who are doing anything in the real physical world outside cyberspace. And if they don't all immediately start packing the U-Haul to emigrate, which admittedly most of them wouldn't, then at least they'd all come over to our forum and play there. And the poor little webmaster would lose all his friends and have to go back to playing World of Warcraft all alone. Not to mention losing his financial donors who would prefer to support genuine activity in the real world. And we can't have that now, can we? Anyway, I won't go on and on about this, Burton, but you asked, and others have as well. Every now and then, I have to mention these things because you're not the only one who notices them. Also, I will say this. Stormfront does seem to be a little bit better than the others. Any mention of me or the Northwest is completely and automatically banned on VNN, eNationalist, White News Now, and a couple of others. And the slightest mention of me or the NF or the novels gets the account closed and the IP blocked. But depending on which Stormfront moderators see which posts, some pro-Northwest posts and a few threads discussing the Northwest do seem to have stayed up for a while on Stormfront. Although I understand that recently a couple of moderators have been pretty much cleansing the board of anything pro-Northwest over the past couple of months. Now, I don't know. I don't actually look at Stormfront. I haven't done for years. It's a pity. It's still probably the largest audience in the movement, and I would really love to conduct a serious discussion of the Northwest Imperative in front of that audience. But what can I tell you? Don Black is MIA, and apparently the usual V-Bulletin thing has happened. What happens is you get this little clique of moderators who wormed their way in there somehow, hiding under false names so nobody knows who they really are or what their agenda is, and they've combined to play King of the Hill and throw certain people off the hill, as witness the banning of any discussion of alternate 9/11 theories on Stormfront. Well, so I'm told they've done. Like I say, I don't actually look at these forums. I just don't have the time. Anyway, this next email is from Tyler in Illinois, I think. Sorry, Tyler, I've forgotten where you're from. Hello there, Harold. Is it hard to write a book? Signed, Tyler. Dear Tyler, yes. Okay, this week we're going to have a featured musical guest, the Irish folk group Clannad from Gweedore in County Donegal. The female lead singer is Mari Brennan, who is the sister of the somewhat more successful New Age Celtic-type singer Inya. In fact, if memory serves, Inya was a member of Clannad for a while during the early years. Now, in 1982, Yorkshire Television in England produced what is, in my personal opinion, the best IRA movie ever made. It's called Harry's Game. Basically, it's about an undercover SAS operative being inserted into Catholic West Belfast to track down a specific Provo assassin. Now, the movie was good, but to everyone's surprise, the theme song became a number one hit in Britain and Ireland for a number of weeks. It's actually a musical version of an Irish children's nursery rhyme, but I remember at the time reading that British reporters, who didn't speak Irish, of course, were nervous about what it might mean in the context of an IRA movie. And they were calling up their counterparts at RTE in Dublin and asking, what do these lyrics mean? I mean, it's not saying cut all Englishmen's throats or anything, is it? And the Irish would tell, no, don't worry, it's just a children's rhyme. Anyway, this is the theme from Harry's Game. I know regular listeners are probably getting bored with my constant rehashes of the Edgar Steele case, but I'm sorry, this is important. We in our movement have a horrible habit of simply cutting people loose once the prison doors slam shut. Plus, I cannot overemphasize how important it is not to allow this case to fall off the radar. There is nothing we can do to save Edgar Steele's life or even to make sure that they don't get away with it. Well, at least nothing we can do about it that, realistically, we're ever going to do. The most any of us can do is make sure that this man's name and what was done to him is not allowed to fall into the abyss of silence that muffles most of what this tyranny does. That much I can and I will do. In June of 2010, North Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. The alleged assassin was a man named Larry Fairfax, an FBI informer who had previously been inserted into Steele's home, posing as a handyman to spy on the Steele family, before any of this came up. While he was working there, Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of gold and silver coins and bullion that the Steeles were keeping on their property in anticipation of a Federal Reserve currency crash brought on by Barack Obama's incompetence. The final whereabouts of that gold and silver seems to be something of a mystery. Apparently, the FBI allowed Fairfax to keep at least some of it as a kind of bonus or reparations for the annoyance and inconvenience of having to spend 16 months in a minimum security prison in the service of the Bureau. The basis of Edgar Steele's conviction were audio files fabricated by FBI technicians, supposedly discussions between himself and Fairfax about murder for hire, which appeared even to a layman who first heard them to sound strained, stilted, unnatural, and obviously doctored at the key points and phrases. The Steele tapes were not only forgeries, apparently they weren't even very good ones. At Steele's trial, two international audio engineering experts who were prepared to swear that the tapes were fraudulent were barred from testifying by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Edgar Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a public defender named Roger Peavin, was a raging alcoholic who at the time was being sued by three members of his own legal staff for various acts of drunken misconduct, according to numerous reports in the media, notably the Spokane Spokesman Review. Steele's second defense attorney, a man named Robert McAllister, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life's savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling his client's money, and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. Many suspect that this second attorney may have struck a deal with the government to keep himself out of prison by deliberately taking a dive in the courtroom and bungling Steele's defense. His performance at trial was lackluster, to say the least, and he refused to put his client on the witness stand, which always looks very bad to a jury. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained to either Ed or Cindy Steele while the trial was going on. As icing on the cake, I've spoken to persons present in the courtroom during the trial who told me that Ed Steele, quote-unquote, looked like a zombie, confused and disoriented, and he seemed completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. No one knows for sure why the federal government of the United States did this horrible thing to Edgar Steele. He must have pissed somebody off really bad, although I don't see how. Ed had withdrawn from the Idaho governor's race due to ill health. He just had open-heart surgery. I have this horrible suspicion that this whole ghastly business may simply have been some kind of grotesque experiment on the part of the FBI simply to see how far they could go and how much they could get away with in arresting and destroying critics of the regime. Edgar Steele is being held in the Victorville facility, which is well known throughout the federal system as a kind of toilet where human beings are flushed away. Among other things, the water supply in the prison is known to be contaminated with carcinogens and toxic waste, which facilitates the decline in health of those federal prisoners whom the government wishes to hear no more of. The guards and the staff there are issued bottled water to drink. The inmates are not, and are forced to drink and bathe in poison. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, no one leaves except in a body bag. Edgar Steele has been sent there to die. Yet there's another person in all this who has suffered almost as much as Edgar Steele. That's his wife Cindy, his alleged victim, who from the day of his arrest has never ceased to support her husband and has thereby earned almost as much hatred and vicious persecution from the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office as Edgar himself. Now that's a topic we'll be exploring in further Radio Free Northwest's. This week, though, I'm going to play for you Cindy's speech on the courthouse steps when the jury, who had never been allowed to hear Steele's defense witnesses, brought in the guilty verdict, which the judge made it clear he expected of them.
I am the wife, the proud wife of Edgar J. Steele, and I am here to tell you that this is a cover-up, a frame-up to cover up Larry Fairfax's crimes against me. My husband is innocent. We had the proof. We had all the proof, and it was the court system that would not allow our experts that know that those tapes are falsified, which I could hear, I knew, they know, but they wouldn't allow it in because of their restrictions, because they don't want to hear the truth. And it's Larry Fairfax's criminal activities to cover up his theft of the $45,000 and him attempting to murder me on his own to get rid of me so that my husband would be put away. This is not the end because I will fight and support him. And no, I don't have Stockholm Syndrome and just believing because I love him, because that is a line that nobody would cross with me, because this is my life at stake, and I was never in any danger for my husband.
Is there an appeal?
There will be an appeal, yes.
And do you feel like the jury didn't hear the evidence they needed to hear then?
Of course they didn't hear the evidence. RX audio experts weren't allowed in. It's not that we didn't have them. They were denied to be heard because they knew if they heard the audio experts, that would prove that he did not make those conversations, despite the fact that I heard all the discrepancies in those tapes. I've been married to him for 25 years. I know his voice. I know how he says things. And every time I tried to get out what I have investigated and learned, they objected, and I was not allowed to say everything.
When the verdict was read today, what was your reaction when you heard it?
Well, I'm not sure it has totally set in, but it is devastating to me, our children, the rest of his family, his brother and sister and his friends, his supporters, all of us that have done investigating to know that he is innocent. And then they're going to let Larry Fairfax, who put the bomb on my car, off with a plea deal of 18 months, the guy that is behind this and all his accomplices.
What? I'm sorry, I wasn't here for the sentencing. What was the sentence for your husband right now?
I don't know what the sentence. He has just been found. They have just found that he is guilty.
So, okay, I'm sorry. They just found him guilty. It wasn't the sentencing.
No.
Okay, I'm sorry. Could you read what his reaction was when you were in court?
Disbelief, shock, devastated. They took our life and turned it into an ugly story, and it is farthest from the truth. They took an investigation on the Russian bride scam that he was investigating for a client that I knew about, and he never did anything wrong with that, and they took our lives and just turned it into an ugly story, which is farthest from the truth. And they wouldn't listen to me. The government continually told lies to me. Sokka got up on that stand and lied when I said I didn't cooperate the day of the 11th. I cooperated. And I will fight this until my last breath, because it is wrong, and people need to start waking up, because it's not going to be long that they're going to come after anybody that speaks up against the government because of the truth. They're going to come after us. That's how they're using to shut us up and deny us our freedom of speech. Whether you disagree, agree, or a mutual on my husband's point of views, that is not the point. He had the right to freedom of speech in this country, and we are losing it, and the more people speak out, they're going to be coming after us, and you're going to look back on this day and realize that Ed, among others that have already been put away, is just the beginning.
And I know you've said this before, but you feel like the prosecution, his past cases that he was involved in, played a large part in his prosecution?
Absolutely. What I didn't get to say on the stand is that we've had personal death threats as young as my daughter when she was 9 years old. My personal one, which was found by the FBI to go back to the ADL, my personal threat was that the FBI would love to see us dead. And as soon as they found out it was the ADL, the FBI threw their hands up, and we're not that important to protect. So yes, my husband has always been the one to speak out, but I am going to be the one to speak out, because I'm fighting for every American's right to freedom of speech, and I will follow my husband's footsteps, because he is an honorable, loving man. He has always taken care of us, loved us, and has fought for everybody's rights to freedom of speech. And yes, he represented Richard Butler, never the Aryan Nations, and that is what the press keeps pressing. He did not fully believe in Richard Butler's beliefs, but everybody had to tie him, and everybody in this country has a right to representation. He stood up and stood up for Richard Butler's right to freedom of speech. And he has been chastised ever since.
What's the next step for you?
Working feverishly to get his appeal done because, like I said, he is innocent, he did not do this, and we have the proof which was denied in that courtroom.
Shall we go?
And I am done. Please forgive my outburst because this is the most devastating thing I have ever had in my life.
Thank you for speaking, Chris. Can I get that mic?
Normally, I don't read out the works of other writers on this show, nor do I often even actually read my own work, although I do use talking points and occasionally scripts. I believe that people who tune into Radio Free Northwest should, whenever possible, hear something new and as spontaneous as possible. Sometimes I ad-lib a lot of this program, and I've gotten sufficiently skilled in editing out all the yees and uhs and like, you knows, so that I think most people can no longer tell when I'm speaking off the cuff and when I'm using a script. But as part of our Edgar Steele segment this week, I'm going to read what I consider to be one of the best short pieces that Ed ever did. I would love to play it for you in his own voice, spoken, but there is no downloadable MP3 file available, and so I'm going to have to read it. Now, this is from July the 2nd in the year 2002, over 10 years ago, when Ed was defending the Christine family against the regime's attempts to steal their children and put them into prison for refusing to raise their kids as the government commanded. After his defense of Richard Butler and the Aryan Nations, this is probably Edgar Steele's most famous or infamous politically incorrect case, and in my opinion may have been the straw that broke the camel's back as far as the establishment is concerned and put him on somebody's death list, even though it was 10 years ago. People like Brian and Ruth Christine aren't supposed to have attorneys. Not real ones who actually defend them anyway. Now, this article is entitled, No Justice for the Politically Incorrect. Below is the text of a press release I sent out following a court hearing this morning which ends the long ordeal of the Christines in Grants Pass, Oregon. Brian and Ruth have agreed to plead out to a single charge each of criminal mistreatment. This doesn't mean they did it. On the contrary, they have agreed to this for three reasons. Number one, to prevent any of their children being brought back to take the stand and testify against them, as the Douglas County prosecutor had little Lydia do in the trial we went through in May. When she gets older, the psychological trauma of realizing that it was her testimony that sent her parents to prison will be substantial. Even in the face of a system which has repeatedly brutalized them, the Christines have once again demonstrated what we've known all along. They are good parents. Number two, because by pre-agreement all the time the judge assesses will be served concurrent with the time they received in Douglas County. This means that the time sentenced is irrelevant. That they each have another felony on their record is also of little consequence in face of what has already been done to them. Number three, after their experience with the Douglas County jury, the Christines rightfully did not trust either judge or jury to treat them properly this time either. Can't say I blame them. Yet another example of what has become a mantra for me. The politically incorrect cannot get justice in America today. Are you homeschooling? Are you Christian? Are you vegetarian? Are you politically conservative? No, not the neocon kind. Do you ever spank your children? Are you barely scraping by financially? If you have young white children and can answer yes to one or more of the above, you are seriously at risk from the Child Protective Services agency in your state. Right and wrong has nothing to do with it. I got a call last Saturday afternoon as I was working in my study at home from the neighbor of a friend who lives just over the border in Washington State. Seems someone had phoned in an anonymous tip to the authorities about his children. He has 4, aged 2 through 7. Fortunately, nobody was home when CPS came calling in the company of a sheriff's deputy. They left cards. This fellow had heard of what could happen and was terrified. Seems he had a bit of a dispute going with a neighbor. Do the math. Now, since no court had yet acquired jurisdiction over any member of his family, that typically comes once they trump up something with which to charge the parents, I was able to tell him the following. Put your children and as many of your important possessions as you can into your station wagon and leave the state before nightfall. Never come back. Have a friend pack and send the rest, or have a yard sale. Hire a real estate agent to sell your house for you. Call in Monday morning and quit your job. Start a new life elsewhere. Extreme? Not at all. Houses, friends, and jobs are easy to find. Children are irreplaceable. Once you are in the system, you stand a very real chance of ending up like Brian and Ruth Christine. Staying out of the system is, by far, the best solution. Once CPS comes calling, the only way to ensure that you stay out of the system is to get out right then. Usually, CPS will come by at least once before seeking any court orders. That will be your one chance to stay out of the system, by doing just what I told the hapless fellow above to do. Once you are in the system, which can happen on the first visit if you let them in the door, the only way out is to play by the rules. That was where Brian and Ruth went wrong. If you're home when they come, never, 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 never let them in the door without a warrant signed by a magistrate. Make them show it to you. Never talk to them. These cases are usually constructed out of the parents' own statements. Make them stand on the porch. Show them the kid through the window to demonstrate that he or she is okay. Tell them to get a warrant before they come back again. Same drill, even if a cop is standing next to them. Do not believe anything Child Protective Services tells you. They must have a warrant to enter your home. When they leave, take no more than 2 hours to pack and get out. You must leave the state altogether and forever. Once you are served with a warrant, or you or any child is taken into custody, you are in the system because you ignored the basic rule of getting out. And your only real hope is to get a lawyer well acquainted with CPS and the child custody courts. Remember these basic rules, and you will be able to keep your children in an increasingly hostile and tyrannical America. Signed, Ed. I might mention that this article, No Justice for the Politically Incorrect, was the inspiration for something I made up and put into my first Northwest novel, The Hill of the Ravens. The whole thing about it takes a village coming and stealing white children and basically selling them to the highest bidder, to yuppies and homosexuals. And by the way, that's perfectly true. There is a tremendous market, both legal and illegal right now, for white infants especially, but any very young white children who are healthy, don't have any genetic diseases, anything like that. And there are rich, yuppie, liberal couples and faggot couples and whatnot who are willing to pay huge amounts of money in the form of legal fees and various other basically disguised bribes in order to get hold of a white child. I am not making any of this up, and neither was Ed Steele. Okay, after that thoroughly depressing part of the podcast, I think we could use some peace and beauty, like a song in one of the most beautiful of all Aryan languages. This is Mari Brennan and Clannad.
Sakara mokre evening, comrades. Lately, I've been reading something called The Arctic Home in the Vedas, and I'm still reading that, so I can't comment on that just now. So I was thinking, maybe I would just talk to you about something that I've found happening in my life. It's something that another comrade was speaking about on this show some months back, maybe even last year. He was talking about something of a rather mystical nature, a magic transference that he thought was happening in terms of his plans to come, because he said that he started packing his things, and as he started packing his things, I think he said that he got a job offer as he was packing, and how that even though there's no physical connection between him packing and a job offer coming in, that's what happened. And I noticed something like that in my life recently. Sometimes I look on the internet and I look at things in the homeland, things like apartments or jobs. And I found something recently. Now, I'm not going to say exactly what it was because I don't want to go into any possible personal itineraries on this show, because we have people who listen to the show that maybe it's not really their, how should I put this, they're listeners, but they're not really supporters or sympathizers. So I don't want to get into any personal itineraries, and I don't want to say where in the homeland, I don't want to say what it was, but at any rate, I had done some research and so forth into a certain part of the homeland. And then I ended up meeting someone who actually has a tie to this particular part of the homeland that I was looking at. I'm becoming rather friendly, this individual. I don't know where the relationship will go. It may remain a friendship. It may end up evolving into more. I don't know at this point. But I could see where possibly, who knows, maybe it'll turn into a scouting trip for me. I can't believe it. I was telling Harold about it, and I said, is this some sort of a godsend, or is there something more sinister going on? You know, in our line of work, you never know. You don't know quite who to trust sometimes. And Harold was telling me, he said, well, it's probably just a coincidence. So I'm pursuing this, and I don't know whether this is my imagination, but it just seems rather incredible because I seldom run into anyone with ties to the homeland. This situation seems like it could be really a godsend for me. So that was just something that I wanted to share with you without getting into, of course, too much detail. You know, I have to admit that it's a challenge trying to come up with something every week. I don't manage to come up with something every week. Of late, I've tried to be on as much as I can. I know that we need content for this show, and I know that it's important to keep the show up just to keep people interested in this concept. I can sympathize with the difficulty of doing a show every week. Now, personally, I was never that fond of the panels. I believe that this is a serious show. I think that it should be about informing people, and yes, there's an entertainment element. I mean, it should be an interesting show to listen to. But I think the interest in this show is in, so far as the content is valid and useful for the interests of migration and promoting the Northwest Imperative. So, I honestly enjoy the more serious parts of it. And I also enjoyed the new musical guest that we're having. I do hope to hear more from him. Honestly, it's people like that that make me wish that I could sing. Unfortunately, I have to leave that to other people. And, you know, I'm sorry if sometimes I'm redundant on this show, if I say something twice, or if I get some little thing wrong here or there. I should say that I was recently doing a little more research on the Icelandic woman that I reported on, and it turns out that she was actually born in Vinland. She didn't just travel to Vinland. She was born there, and you know, again, putting something out every single week, sometimes there's a sense of urgency to put something out, and I honestly do the best that I can do. Sometimes I like my content better than I like my delivery. So I'm sorry if sometimes my delivery isn't perfect. Sometimes I fall in love with the sound of my own voice, and then when I hear myself on the show, I realize, oh, there was something I could have done differently or said differently. But at any rate, I make the contributions that I'm able to make. So, what can I say? I'm glad that Harold continues to have me on the show, and I enjoy being on this show and, you know, looking forward to it every week. And some shows I enjoy more than others. At any rate, I'm just glad to be helpful. So thank you for listening and tuning in and all of that. Good night.
I want to talk about another subject now that isn't an email question per se. It's just something I've been seeing on a number of white nationalist sites, and a question I've gotten a few variations on myself, and it's something we need to think about. I suppose this question or issue can best be summed up as follows. What will white people do when Obama wins? As I am convinced he will. Okay, let's try to work this out. Now remember, we're trying to teach ourselves to think, not to feel. Now, the first thing I can tell you for sure is that what we will all get a good look at is the naked Obama and liberal agenda, now that he no longer has to worry about getting reelected. Or if he does, he'll be planning on having all those illegal aliens legalized and on the voter rolls by 2016, and from that point on, nationwide elections will merely be a formality anyway once he gets rid of the 22nd Amendment. If he can't get Congress to amnesty the illegals for him, or revoke the 22nd Amendment for him, Obama will simply do it by decree, the same way he decreed the DREAM Act after Congress rejected it twice. He's learned that he can break the law and violate the Constitution, and nothing will be done about it. He will simply order elections registrars to register millions of third world aliens to vote, like he simply ordered the ICE to stop arresting and deporting them. And the spineless white jellyfish who control the boards of elections around the country will crumple like a styrofoam cup. Once the illegals are all registered to vote, the Democrats will probably not even have to use vote fraud anymore. Normal white people will simply be outnumbered and outvoted at the polls perpetually from now on, especially given the electoral college system. If Obama wins, I think we can assume that from this point on until its final collapse, this country will be ruled by the liberal wing of the Democrat Party. Probably with the help of some Republican collaborators in Congress who will sell out in exchange for some committee chairmanships and control of at least some of that lovely money. White conservatives of both parties will be an aging minority who will eventually die out. The best we can hope for is some kind of fracture in the power structure between the niggers, the Jews, the feminists, the Hispanics, or some combination thereof, which will accelerate the collapse. Which, by the by, is most assuredly coming. I know, Rush Limbaugh has a whole set of problems all on his own. He's the mouthpiece of the Republican establishment, and he's a raving, screaming Zionist. I get it, believe me. However, he does have some good points on occasion, and last week he did a whole section on one of his shows which discussed the findings of a number of very serious economists, Wall Street big knobs, financial analysts, treasury people, and people who, generally speaking, are in the know. I'm not talking about our own little movement's self-appointed financial whizzes and money experts who've been screaming doom and gloom for the past 50 years now. I'm talking about people like Standard & Poor, heads of stock exchanges, various international bank presidents, so forth and so on. I'm talking the real deal. The fact is that a surprising number of these genuine authorities are convinced that the existing financial status quo will quite literally not survive another 4 years of Barack Hussein Obama. Needless to say, the mainstream media aren't allowing us to hear anything from these for-real experts, but it makes sense. Anybody who's ever had his credit cards get away from him understands that no one, not a person, not a nation, can continue to live and function indefinitely on borrowed money. At some point in time, you have to stop the merry-go-round and get off. Or else the merry-go-round will turn into a roller coaster, it will gain breakneck speed and go hurtling off the tracks and crash. Now, this is what is going to happen to the entire American economy if we have to try to endure 4 more years of Obama. I'm not talking about some vague, balloon-going-up right-wing fantasy. I'm talking about an imminent collapse of the entire American economic and financial system within 18 months to 2.5 years after Obama's re-election. Obama will run out of money to keep the balloon inflated, Then he will order the Jew, Ben Bernanke, to fire up those printing presses and print more, as he already has done 3 times. American money will become worthless, and it will take $135,000 to buy a Big Mac and fries at McDonald's, and what's left of America will simply crumble into dust like a vampire who's been staked. And yes, I know, I've already told you that I recall people saying the same thing about Jimmy Carter in 1976. All I can say is that Carter, for all his many failings, wasn't a nigger. And this time, it's for real. I'm tempted to start giving specific examples, like the fact that the state of California is now borrowing $40 million per day to pay welfare alone. But what's the point? We hear all this every day because the media can no longer suppress the mess we're in, and yet it just rolls off us like water off a duck's back. None of it registers. The numbers are too big, and most white people are convinced that politics has nothing to do with them anyway. White Americans have been so dumbed down that not only can they not see the impending crash coming, they can't understand that it concerns them. Okay, so that's the second thing we can look forward to when Obama's reelected, after amnestying the illegals and creating a one-party third world state. A complete economic collapse which will probably have everybody foraging in dumpsters for food the 1% throughout. Yes, I mean you. No, really, you. Only there won't be too much to forage, because the 1% will by then have completely withdrawn into what amounts to a handful of fortified enclaves, mostly on the coast, surrounded by razor wire and guard dogs and armed security. Back about 100 years ago, J.P. Morgan was asked what he would do if the people ever really did rise up against him, and he replied, "I would hire one half of them to shoot the other half. America's been doing that for years." What the hell do you think gated communities and all those closed-circuit TV cameras and the FBI and their drones over America are about? Now, the third thing we can expect, if Obama's reelected, is a massive Middle East war one way or the other. And to be sure, we can probably expect that as if Romney's elected as well. Now, Benny Netanyahu may or may not launch his bombers from Israel sometime in the next month, but if he doesn't, it will most likely be because he has come to some arrangement with Obama, whereby, in exchange for Benny not embarrassing Barry during the election, Obama will send American bombers alongside of Israel's in late November. And yes, I have to say again, it is very likely that there will be such a war if, through some last-minute spasm of white electoral effort, Romney becomes president instead. I think this war is pretty much in our cards, people, no matter what. And it's going to have to happen fairly soon, since the general consensus of opinion is that beyond about February or March, all the Persian nuclear stuff will be so deep buried underground that there would not be any point at all in launching an attack. Of course, that may not make any difference, since the point of the whole exercise is to start the war and not to destroy any alleged nuclear centrifuges or whatever. Now, who will fight this war to keep the Straits of Hormuz open? Who will fight to preserve Israel from the consequences of its own behavior? Who will pay for it? How will they pay for it? How long before the U.S. military implodes under the strain of fighting 3, 4, 5 or more wars in the Islamic world at once? How long before American soldiers simply go insane from the endless deployments and never seeing home, and they can no longer be relied on? How long before this country is forced, with its back against the wall, to revive the draft? What kind of unholy mess do you think that's going to cause? Guess we're going to find out. Not a very rosy picture of your future, is it? Don't like it? Well, my conscience is clear. I've told you what to do about it. Those of you who are on the Freedom's Sons Review Committee will recall that Section 3 of the novel was entitled The Gods of the Dawn, and in that section I discussed certain theories about the origins of our race, as I've done before on this program. In Ireland, in County Meath, there stands a great ring of Neolithic stones built by ancient white people. I've been there. It's called Newgrange, and it is estimated to be approximately 5,250 years old. And no one really knows what it was used for, but it was obviously something of great religious significance to early peoples, because it is in fact a kind of sunken temple or chamber into which have been cut small slits and holes and angles in the stone of intricate complexity, such that the inmost chamber is always pitch black, except on the morning of December 21st, the morning of the winter solstice, the shortest day of the year. On that morning alone, when the sun rises through this intricate pattern of carving and reflective surfaces, or however the hell they did it, and we still don't understand that, the inmost chamber is illuminated, filled with the bright light of the dawn. Now, I wasn't in New Grange on the morning of December 21st. You have to book those excursions with the Irish Tourist Board years in advance. But this is what was in the back of my mind when I entitled that part of my book, The Gods of the Dawn. This song from Clannad is called New Grange. Many years ago, the great Alexander Solzhenitsyn, survivor of Stalin and his Jews in their gulag, the chronicler and witness to the most terrible time and events in human history, wrote as follows. And how we burned in the camps later, thinking, what would things have been like if every security operative, when he went out at night to make an arrest, had been uncertain whether he would return alive and had to say goodbye to his family? or if during periods of mass arrests, as for example in Leningrad when they arrested a quarter of the entire city, people had not simply sat there in their lairs, paling with terror at every bang of the downstairs door and at every step on the staircase, but had understood they had nothing left to lose and had boldly set up in the downstairs hall an ambush of half a dozen people with axes, hammers, pokers, or whatever else was at hand. The organs would very quickly have suffered a shortage of officers and transport, and notwithstanding all of Stalin's thirst, the cursed machine would have ground to a halt. If we didn't love freedom enough. And even more, we had no awareness of the real situation. We purely and simply deserved everything that happened afterward. I think it's significant that after many years in comfortable exile in Vermont, Solzhenitsyn chose to return to Russia, where, in one of his last recorded interviews before his death in 2008, he said that he now felt much more free in Russia than here, with the Patriot Act and the cameras everywhere, and the drones and the legalized torture, the perpetual spying, the sinister demand for conformity or else. A man who survived Stalin saw much that he could recognize in George W. Bush. Solzhenitsyn would have recognized even more in Barack Hussein Obama. I've spent the past 40 years doing what I can with my feeble efforts, writing and speaking, to try and make a dent in this stone wall of insupportable tyranny. And tyranny it is. When I was young and first read 1984, everyone thought it was science fiction. Today it's reality, with spy cameras everywhere and drones flying overhead and hate crime and hate speech laws that establish thought crime as a criminal offense. In Obama's America, everyone must love Big Brother. And I do mean brother. Step out of line and you get a visit from the Secret Service. I know. It's coming, people. When and how exactly, I don't know, but it won't be too much longer now. I can't really get into good rhetorical form until I know a little more about exactly when and how it's coming, but I will say this. I hope to God I never have to write a paragraph like Solzhenitsyn wrote, the one that I began this section with. Just once in my life, before I drop dead, or before they drag me away and throw me in a cell without my medication and wait for me to die. That may be what they've done to Edgar Steele, by the way. Nobody's heard from him for several months, so he may already be dead. Anyway, just once before I hit the road, I'd like to see my people resist. Why not? Hey, unlikelier things have happened. Anyway, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front. Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.